Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're the show that takes, stacks of dense research and boils it down. We try to find the most important, sometimes surprising nuggets of knowledge just for you. Today, we're diving into something super relevant. It affects pretty much everyone's daily life, especially if you're in fields like, say, software delivery, multitasking. We all do it. We probably all think we're pretty good at it, right? But what does the science actually say?
Yeah, so our source today, it's this really foundational paper, Executive Control of Cognitive Processes and Task Switching, Rubenstein, Meyer, and Evans. And our mission here really is to pull out the most important insights. We're focusing particularly on this fascinating gap, the gap between how productive we feel when we switch tasks and the reality of what the cognitive findings actually show. So this deep dive, it's basically a shortcut to getting properly informed on this. It's critical stuff.
Absolutely. And just think about your day for a sec. Maybe you're trying to cook dinner while keeping an eye on the kids. Or, maybe you're driving and quickly trying to answer a text. Don't do that, by the way. But we all juggle tasks. The real question is, does our brain actually multitask? Like, do two things truly at once? Or is it just switching? Just really, really fast switching between them.
Okay, let's unpack this. So before we get into the nitty-gritty, what's the main idea? What does this paper really want us to grasp about how our brains handle all these demands? Because, traditional psychology often looked at repetitive tasks, same thing over and over. But daily life, like the authors say, it's about performing multiple tasks either simultaneously or in rapid alternation.
Exactly. And to explain how we manage that, researchers talk about these things called executive control processes. Mm-hmm. You can kind of think of them as your brain's internal supervisor. They handle selecting tasks, starting them, running them, stopping them. But the big question the paper asks is, are these control processes really separate? Are they distinct from just, doing the task itself?
Right.
So what was the first big finding? When we switch, what happens? Is there a cost or is it seamless?
Well, the paper gets right to it. Task alternation yielded switching time costs. Plain and simple. It means there's a measurable time penalty every single time you switch tasks.
A penalty. Okay. So it's not free.
Not free at all.
Huh.
And how they measured it? Well, the research mostly uses what they call the successive tasks procedure.
Successive tasks.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So think of it like this. People weren't truly doing two things at the exact same moment. It was more like do one math problem, then immediately do a different kind of math problem, one right after the other. That way they could measure the time it took to make that switch. And a key reason for those costs is something called proactive interference.
Proactive interference, like the old task getting in the way of the new one.
Exactly. Okay. Imagine you were just deep into one puzzle, and then you immediately jump to a totally different kind. The rules, the strategy from that first puzzle, they might still be kind of lingering in your mind. And that interferes with how you tackle the new one. That's proactive interference.
Hmm. That makes sense. And apparently, we've known about this cost for ages. The paper mentions Gerseld's study from 1927. That's almost a century ago. He found mean times taken to complete columns of stimuli. Task switching increased the mean completion times. So yeah, it took longer. And here's where it gets really interesting for productivity. These costs increased with rule complexity. So the harder the task's rules, the bigger the time penalty for switching into it.
Yes, exactly. And then Spector and Biederman in 76, they added another piece. They found that giving people explicit visual cues, like literally seeing a 1 plus 3 or 1 e 3 sign for arithmetic problems, that actually reduced the switching cost.
Ah, so hints help.
Hints help. It suggests our brain isn't just passively stuck. It actually uses those cues to kind of prepare for the next task.
Okay, so if the brain can prepare, what's really causing these costs then? This seems to set up a bit of a debate, right? The paper brings up this alternative idea, task set inertia, or TSI. That's from Allport and his colleagues in 94. Their idea was maybe it's not active control causing the cost, but more like you said, proactive interference. Like a sticky residue from the last task just hangs around and gets in the way. Is it just passive stickiness? Or is the brain actively doing something?
Right. And Allport had some compelling points for their task set inertia theory. They found, for instance, that switching costs didn't seem to depend on the scope of the switch, meaning switching one rule or two rules had roughly the same cost, which is a bit odd if it's active control. And crucially, these costs sometimes stuck around even after really long breaks between tasks, like over a second.
A whole second? Wow.
Yeah, which suggests maybe it wasn't active control because wouldn't that have finished its job by then? They also found costs were smaller when the tasks were really different, which fits the idea of less interference, less stickiness.
But then other researchers came along, Rogers and Monsell in 95. they found some details that kind of poked holes in TSI, didn't they? Like, they found switching costs even when using neutral, irrelevant characters in the task. Stuff where that sticky residue idea shouldn't really apply. If it's just passive interference, why is there still a cost? That seems like a pretty big challenge to the inertia idea.
It was a big one. And Rogers and Moncel also highlighted something critical about the RSI, the response stimulus interval.
That's the pause between tasks, right?
Exactly. If that pause was predictable, if you knew how long the gap would be, then longer pauses reduce the switching costs. But if the pause was unpredictable, the costs stayed high.
Ah, so the brain can prepare if it knows it has time.
Precisely. It suggests our brain can and does actively prepare for the next task if it knows when it's coming. It uses that predictable downtime.
So it's not just passively waiting for the stickiness to wear off. It's doing something active.
Right. And another key thing they found, the costs were mostly hitting on the very first trial, right after a switch. They didn't seem to fade away gradually over several trials.
Which points more towards an immediate active reconfiguration, doesn't it? Rather than a slow decay of interference.
Exactly. So based on this, Rogers and Moncel proposed a model with two kinds of executive control. There's endogenous control, that's the flexible, top-down, anticipatory preparation you do when you have time. And then there's exogenous control that's more bottom-up, triggered by the stimulus itself, making immediate adjustments on the fly. And this really set the stage for the main paper we're looking at today.
Got it. So that brings us to Rubenstein, Meyer, and Evans and their integrated model. They proposed these two distinct executive control stages, right? Goal shifting and rule activation. So if our brain is doing these two distinct steps, what does that mean for how productive we feel we are? Does it explain that gap?
Let's break those stages down. First, goal shifting. The paper says this stage keeps track of current and future tasks, inserting and deleting their goals. It's flexible. It can happen before you even say the next thing you need to work on, that's the endogenous part, or it can happen after, triggered by the stimulus, the exogenous part. Think of it like updating your mental GPS. Okay, deleting the old destination, putting in the new one. It's setting the intention.
Okay, updating the GPS makes sense. What's the next stage?
The next stage is rule activation. This is where the brain enables the rules for selecting the current task response and disabling the rules for selecting the prior task response. This part is often triggered by the new stimulus itself. It's like loading the right software program into your computer's active memory, and maybe even actively deleting the old program's active components, making sure the right operations are ready to go.
So the brain is quite literally like rewiring itself, or at least reconfiguring its active settings for the new task. How did the experiments in this paper actually show these stages are separate? How did they prove it?
Right. The experiments are key here. Experiment one used these pattern classification tasks. They found something really interesting. If they made the task itself harder, like making the patterns really difficult to tell apart that slow down overall response time, sure. But it did not affect the switching costs.
Oh. So task difficulty and switching cost are different things.
Exactly. It's like they are separate dials in your brain. Basic task difficulty is one thing, the cost of switching is another. But when they changed the complexity of the rules simple versus complex classification rules, that significantly increased the switching costs, which directly supports the idea of that separate rule activation stage needing more time for complex rules.
Fascinating. Okay, so task difficulty is one cost, rule complexity adds another switching cost layer. Then experiment two looked at arithmetic, like switching between adding and subtracting or multiplying and dividing. Were these control processes additive? Did they stack up?
Yes, they did. So giving people cues, like seeing the plus or X sign beforehand, that reduced switching costs. That points to the goal shifting stage being helped by the cue. It let the brain prepare. And then rule complexity, the fact that multiplication and division are just harder than addition and subtraction for most people, that increased switching costs.
Evidence for rule activation taking longer.
Precisely. And the crucial insight was that these two effects, the benefit from the cue and the cost from complexity, they were additive. They seemed to affect different stages independently, just like the model predicted. And here's a huge perception versus reality moment for you. Listen to this. Even when people were switching between simple addition and subtraction, with cues helping them prepare, there was still a measurable cost. Sometimes as low as maybe 63 milliseconds, but it was there.
63 milliseconds. That's tiny.
It feels tiny, right? Your conscious mind barely registers 63 milliseconds. But think about how many times you quickly switch tasks in a day. Those tiny pauses, those micro costs, they add up. They accumulate into a real drain on your mental energy, your overall processing time. That's the reality, even for what feel like instantaneous, easy context switches.
Wow. Okay, so even the simplest switch isn't actually free.
That's genuinely counterintuitive. Now, experiments 3 and 4 brought in something even more surprising, didn't they? This idea of the asymmetry of familiarity. The paper talked about a task familiarity hypothesis. It suggested switching from a familiar task to an unfamiliar one might actually take longer than going the other way around. That feels backwards, doesn't it? You'd think the unfamiliar task would be harder to start.
You really would think that. Yeah. But the findings showed something else. In experiment 3, switching from addition, which is usually more familiar, to subtraction, typically less familiar, tended to be slower than switching from subtraction back to addition.
Yeah. And the same pattern held for multiplication versus division. Switching away from the more familiar task was slower. And this directly contradicts Allport's task set inertia idea. TSI would predict the opposite, that the lingering familiar task would help, not hinder.
Okay, so this is another perception versus reality thing then.
Absolutely. Our gut feeling about what's easy or hard or what feels familiar, it might not match the actual cognitive mechanics. Experiment 4 really dug into this with regression analysis. It showed that prior task familiarity had a bigger negative impact than current task familiarity.
So it's harder to stop doing the familiar thing than it is to start the unfamiliar thing.
In a way, yes. It's like your brain puts up more of a fight to disengage from a well-worn pathway. It's not just about learning the new rules. It's about the effort involved in actively inhibiting or disabling the old, very practiced rules. Letting go of what you know best takes real cognitive work. And just to add another layer of complexity, there's even a paradoxical reversal for some really high complexity tasks in Experiment 4. For instance, switching from classifying based on size and shading to classifying based on shape and numerosity actually took longer than going the other way.
So familiarity wasn't the only factor there.
It seems not. It suggests that when tasks get really complex, maybe the sheer number of rules or the specific way you have to integrate information might become more important than just simple familiarity. The reality of cognitive load, it's more intricate than just a simple familiarity score.
Okay, this brings us perfectly to our software delivery notebook segment. Because these ideas about hidden costs, complexity, familiarity, they have huge implications for work, especially complex work like software development. And the paper uses the Stroop task as the ultimate example of a potential hidden cost, right? You know the Stroop task, name the ink color of a word, like the word RAD printed in blue ink. You have to say blue. Allport and his colleagues had actually found no switching cost when people switch into doing the standard Stroop task. So how does this model, the Rubinstein model, explain a zero cost switch? Does it mean there's no cost sometimes?
But this is where the model gets really clever and where it nails that perception versus reality point again. It can explain that zero switching cost, even while goal shifting and rule activation are still happening. The idea that these executive control processes, the goal shifting, the rule activation, they might be happening off the critical path.
Off the critical path, like in the background.
Exactly. They're happening in parallel with other, more automatic processes. In the Stroop task, the automatic process is reading the word itself. We're incredibly practiced at reading it super fast. That automatic word reading is so fast, it basically finishes before the slower, more deliberate executive processes, like figuring out the ink color and activating the name the ink rule, have added any extra time to the total. The fast automatic process masks the time taken by the slower control processes.
Okay, let me try an analogy for software delivery then. Maybe you see a developer and they seem to switch instantly. They're writing some standard boilerplate code, something they do all the time, and then bam, they jump straight into debugging a really tricky new bug. On the surface, it looks smooth, instant switch.
Right. That's the perception. But the reality, according to this model, is that their brain is still doing significant work under the hood. It's performing goal shifting. Okay, stop coding boilerplate. New goal is debug this issue. Heck about it. It's performing rule activation. Load up new debugging strategies. Activate error finding rules. And crucially, it's also deactivating those familiar boilerplate coding patterns. So even if the visible switch time looks like zero, the cognitive load is real. It's ongoing. It's hidden. The cost isn't always obvious in the immediate switch time. It might show up later in fatigue, errors, or just slower overall progress.
It's like your brain is running a background process. It's consuming CPU cycles, you know, memory. Even if the app you're looking at feels snappy right now, my brain definitely feels like it's running too many background apps sometimes. Okay, so that really explains it. Continuous context switching, even when it feels easy or instantaneous, It has a real, tangible cost, even if it's often hidden from our perception. It's not about being bad at multitasking. It's just the inherent price your brain pays, a price you might not even notice moment to moment. So, wrapping this up, what have we learned? This deep dive really shows multitasking isn't free, is it? Our brain actively reconfigures itself. It uses these distinct stages, goal-shifting, rule activation. And doing that incurs these measurable switching time costs.
Mm-hmm.
Costs that are affected by task complexity, by cues, even by how familiar we are with the tasks we're switching between.
And I think the most profound takeaway for you listening is that your perception can be really misleading here. That feeling of seamlessly switching or feeling highly productive while juggling, it often hides the reality of significant cognitive effort. Your brain is always doing this background work, these adjustments, whether you consciously feel them happening or not.
So here's a final thought for you to consider. Next time you just quickly switch tasks during your day, maybe checking email during a meeting or flipping between coding and Slack, especially in demanding work like software delivery, consider that invisible work, that hidden cost. How many of those seamless switches are actually chipping away at your cognitive resources, impacting your deep work, your overall long-term productivity? What does the science really mean for how you should manage your own focus, or maybe even how teams structure their work? The research strongly suggests that fewer, deeper blocks of focused work with fewer switches, that's probably the true path to real efficiency, not the constant juggling we often glorify.